Chapter 30. On February 5, 1887, an unsigned editorial in The Ranter, the usually so sarcastic and captious Cho's Weekly, described Vasco da Gama's performance as the most imaginative and singular stunt ever offered to a jaded music hall public. It was repeated at the Ranta River Club several times, but nothing in the program or in publicity notices beyond the definition foreign eccentric gave any indication either of the exact nature of the stunt or of the performer's identity. Rumors, carefully and cleverly circulated by Vasco da Gama's friends, diverted speculations toward his being a mysterious visitor from beyond the Golden Curtain, particularly since at least half a dozen members of a large goodwill circus company that had come from Tartary just then, i.e. on the eve of the Crimean War, three dancing girls, a sick old clown with his old speaking goat, and one of the dancers' husbands, a makeup man, no doubt a multiple agent, had already defected between France and England somewhere in the newly constructed Channel. Vasco da Gama's spectacular success in a theatrical club that habitually limited itself to Elizabethan plays with queens and fairies played by pretty boys made first of all a great impact on cartoonists. Deans, local politicians, national statesmen, and of course the current ruler of the Golden Horde were pictured as Vasco da Gamas by topical humorists. A grotesque imitator, who was really Vasco da Gama himself in an oversophisticated parody of his own act, was booed at Oxford, a women's college nearby, by local rowdies. A shrewd reporter who had heard him curse a crease in the stage carpet commented in print on his Yankee twang. "Dear Mr. Vasco da Gama," received an invitation to Windsor Castle from its owner, a bilateral descendant of Van's own ancestors. But he declined it, suspecting, incorrectly as it later transpired, the misprint to suggest that his incognito had been divulged by one of the special detectives at Cho's, the same, perhaps, who had recently saved the psychiatrist P.O. Tyomkin from the dagger of Prince Potyomkin, a mixed-up kid from Sebastopol, Idaho. During his first summer vacation, Van worked under Tyomkin at the Cho's famous clinic on an ambitious dissertation he never completed, Terra, Eremetic Reality or Collective Dream. He interviewed numerous neurotics, among whom there were variety artists and literary men, and at least three intellectually lucid but spiritually lost cosmologists who either were in telepathic collusion, they had never met and did not even know of one another's existence, or had discovered none knew how or where, by means maybe of forbidden ondulas of some kind, a green world, rotating in space and spiraling in time, which in terms of matter and mind was like ours, and which they described in the same specific details as three people watching from three separate windows would a carnival show in the same street. He spent his free time in gross dissipation. Sometime in August, he was offered a contract for a series of matinees and nights in a famous London theater during the Christmas vacation and on weekends throughout the winter season. He accepted gladly, being badly in need of a strict distraction from his perilous studies. The special sort of obsession under which Tyomkin's patients labored had something about it that made it liable to infect its younger investigators. Vasco da Gama's fame reached inevitably the backwoods of America. A photograph of him, masked, it is true, but unable to mislead a fond relative or faithful retainer, was reproduced by the Lador, Ladoga, Laguna, Lugano, and Luga papers in the first week of 1888. But the accompanying reportage was not. The work of a poet, and only a poet, especially of the Black Belfry group, as some wit said, could have adequately described a certain macabre quiver that marked Van's extraordinary act. The stage would be empty when the curtain went up. Then, after five heartbeats of theatrical suspense, something swept out of the wings, enormous and black, to the accompaniment of dervish drums. The shock of his powerful and precipitous entry affected so deeply the children in the audience that for a long time later, in the dark of sobbing insomnias, in the glare of violent nightmares, nervous little boys and girls relived, with private accretions, something similar to the primordial qualm, a shapeless nastiness, the swoosh of nameless wings, the unendurable dilation of fever which came in a cavern draft from the uncanny stage. Into the harsh light of its gaudily carpeted space, a masked giant, fully 8 feet tall, erupted, running strongly in the kind of soft boots worn by Cossack dancers. A voluminous black shaggy cloak of the burka type enveloped his silhouette inquiétante. According to a female Sorbonne correspondent, we've kept all those cuttings, from neck to knee, or what appeared to be those sections of his body. A caracoule cap surmounted his top, a black mask covered the upper part of his heavily bearded face. The unpleasant colossus kept strutting up and down the stage for a while, then the strut changed to the restless walk of a caged madman. Then he whirled, and to a clash of cymbals in the orchestra and a cry of terror. Perhaps faked, in the gallery, Mosco da Gama turned over in the air and stood on his head. In this weird position, with his cap acting as a pseudopodal pad, he jumped up and down, pogo stick fashion, and suddenly came apart. Van's face, shining with sweat, grinned between the legs of the boots that still shod his rigidly raised arms. Simultaneously, his real feet kicked off and away the false head with its crumpled cap and bearded mask. The magical reversal made the house gasp. Frantic, deafening, delirious, a veritable tempest of applause followed the gasp. He bounded off stage and next moment was back, now sheathed in black tights, dancing a jig on his hands. We devote so much space to the description of his act not only because variety artists of the eccentric race are apt to be forgotten especially soon, but also because one wishes to analyze its thrill. Neither a miraculous catch on the cricket field, nor a glorious goal slammed in at soccer. He was a college blue in both those splendid games. Nor earlier physical successes, such as his knocking out the biggest bully on his first day at River Lane School, had ever given Van the satisfaction Mosco da Gama experienced. It was not directly related to the warm breath of fulfilled ambition, although as a very old man, looking back at a life of unrecognized endeavor, Van did welcome with amused delight, more delight than he had actually felt at the time, the banal acclaim and the vulgar envy that swirled around him for a short while in his youth. The essence of the satisfaction belonged rather to the same order as the one he later derived from self-imposed, extravagantly difficult, seemingly absurd tasks when V.V. sought to express something, which, until expressed, had only a twilight being, or even none at all, nothing but the illusion of the backward shadow of its imminent expression. It was Ada's castle of cards. It was the standing of a metaphor on its head, not for the sake of the trick's difficulty, but in order to perceive an ascending waterfall, or a sunrise in reverse, a triumph, in a sense, over the ardis of time. Thus the rapture young Mosco da Gama derived from overcoming gravity was akin to that of artistic revelation in the sense utterly and naturally unknown to the innocence of critical appraisal, the social scene commentators, the moralists, the idea mongers, and so forth. Van, on the stage, was performing organically what his figures of speech were to perform later in life, acrobatic wonders that had never been expected from them and which frightened children. Neither was the sheer physical pleasure of maniambulation a negligible factor, and the peacock blotches with which the carpet stained the palms of his hands during his gloveless dance routine seemed to be the reflections of a richly colored netherworld that he had been the first to discover. For the tango, which completed his number on his last tour, he was given a partner, a Crimean cabaret dancer in a very short, scintillating frock cut very low on the back. She sang the tango tune in Russian. Под знойним небо Аргентини, под страстный говор мандолини. Neath sultry sky of Argentina, to the hot hum of mandolina. Fragile red-haired Rita, he never learned her real name, a pretty Karaite from Chufut, Kale, where, she nostalgically said, the Crimean cornel, Kizil, bloomed yellow among the arid rocks, bore an odd resemblance to Lucette as she was to look 10 years later. During their dance, all Van saw of her were her silver slippers turning and marching nimbly in rhythm with the soles of his hands. He recouped himself at rehearsals and one night asked her for an assignation. She indignantly refused, saying she adored her husband, the makeup fellow, and loathed England. Chos had long been as famous for the dignity of its regulations as for the brilliancy of its pranksters. Vasco da Gama's identity could not escape the interest and then the knowledge of the authorities. His college tutor, a decrepit and dour homosexual with no sense of humor whatever, and an innate respect for all the conventions of academic life, pointed out to a highly irritated and barely polite Van that in his second year at Chos, he was not supposed to combine his university studies with the circus, and that if he insisted on becoming a variety artist, he would be sent down. The old gentleman also wrote a letter to Dumont, asking him to make his son forget physical stunts for the sake of philosophy and psychiatry, especially since Van was the first American to have won, at 17, the Dudley Prize for an essay on insanity and eternal life. Van was not quite sure yet what compromise pride and prudence might arrive at when he left for America early in June, 1888.